The boy was born the 21st of March, 1685, at Eisenach, where his father, John Ambrosius, was musician to the court and to the town. This John Ambrosius had a twin brother, John Christopher, who was musician to the court and town at Arnstadt, and was so very much like him that even their own wives could not distinguish them except by their dress. These twins were perhaps singulars in their kind, and the most remarkable ever known. They tenderly loved each other, their voice, disposition, the style of their music, their manner of performance, and everything, in short, was alike in them. If one was ill, the other was so likewise. They died also within a short time of each other. They were a subject of astonishment to all who saw and heard them. And yet, the product of John Ambrosius was to astonish the world. For he gave to the world music from the heavens. The boy's name was Johann Sebastian Bach. Johann Sebastian Bach, born in Eisenach in the northern part of Germany in the year of 1685. For nearly two centuries, his family had produced expert musicians, town organists, and bandsmen. In fact, such was the family reputation that in his part of the country, a musician was known as a Bach. Orphaned at the age of 10, he went to live with an older brother who, jealous of his talent, denied to Sebastian a collection of advanced keyboard pieces. So almost nightly for months, the boy climbed to the top shelf of the bookcase, helped himself to the pieces, copied them out by moonlight, and then returned them to their shelf at daybreak. When his brother heard him playing these forbidden pieces, he confiscated the long-labored overcopies. The youngster was left only with permanently impaired eyesight. When Sebastian was 15, he heard of good singing jobs available at Lüneburg, so he hiked the 200 miles to make his fortune. He stayed 3 years, singing in a choir, playing in an orchestra, and spending endless hours at the organ and clavichord. In later years, when asked the secrets of his keyboard brilliance, he said, "If you are equally industrious, you will be equally successful." Johann Sebastian, being thus again left destitute, went in company of one of his schoolfellows named Erdmann, afterwards Imperial Russian resident in Danzig, to Lüneburg, and was engaged there in the choir of St. Michael's School. His inclination to play on the clavier and organ was as ardent at this time as in his more early years, and impelled him to try to do so, to see and to hear everything which, according to the ideas he then entertained, could contribute to his movement. When this view, He not only went several times while he was a scholar from Lüneburg to Hamburg to hear the organist John Adam Reitken, who was at that time very famous, but sometimes also to Celle, in order to get acquainted with the prince's band, which consisted chiefly of Frenchmen, and with the French taste, which was then the novelty in those parts. It is not known on what occasion he removed from Lüneburg to Weimar. It is certain that he became court musician there in 1703, when he was just 18 years of age. He exchanged this place, however, in the following, rather the same year, for that of organist to the new church of Arnstadt, probably to be able to follow his inclination for playing on the organ better than he could do at Weimar, where he was engaged to play the violin. Here he began most zealously to make use of the works of the organists at that time celebrated, whichever of them he could procure in his situation, to improve both in composition and the art of playing on the organ, and to gratify his desire of learning, even made a journey on foot to Lübeck to hear Dietrich Buxtehude, organist to St. Mary's Church in that city, with whose compositions for the organ he was already acquainted. For almost a quarter of a year, he remained a secret hearer of this organist, who was really a man of talent and much celebrated in his times, and then returned with an increased stock of knowledge to his home at Arnstadt. Sebastian Bach was now 32 years of age. He had made such good use of his time, had played, composed, and studied so much, and by this unremitting zeal and diligence acquired such a mastery over every part of the art that he stood like a giant, able to trample all around him into dust. He had long been regarded with admiration and wonder, not only by amateurs, but by judges of the art, when in the year of 1717, Mr. Marchand, formerly much celebrated in France as a performer on the clavier and organ, came to Dresden, where he performed before the king and obtained such appropriation that a large salary was offered him if he would engage in His Majesty's service. Marchand's merit chiefly consisted in a very fine and elegant style of performance, but his ideas were empty and feeble, almost in the manner of Couperin, at least as may be judged by his companions and his compositions. But Johann Sebastian Bach had an equally fine and elegant style, and at the same time, a copiousness of ideas which might perhaps have made Marchand's head giddy if he had heard it. He knew the absolute command of the sturdy young German over his thoughts and his instrument, and wished to produce a contest between him and the French artist in order to give his prince the pleasure of judging their respective merits by comparing them himself. This was the thought that was written down on paper by the concertmeister in Dresden to match Marchand and Bach. They accepted, and upon Bach's arrival in Dresden, it was procured for him an opportunity secretly to hear Marchand. Bach was not discouraged, but wrote to the French artist a polite note, formally inviting him to a musicale and a trial of skill. He offered to extemporize upon the spot whatever Marchand should require of him, but requested the same readiness on his part. As Marchand accepted the challenge, the time and the place for the contest was fixed, with the king's consent. A large company of both sexes and high rank assembled in the house of the marshal, Count Fleming, which was the place appointed for the contest. Bach did not make them wait long for him, but Marchand did not appear. After a long delay, they at last sent to inquire at his lodgings, and the company learned, to their great astonishment, that Marchand had left Dresden in the morning of that day without taking leave of anybody. Bach alone, therefore, had to perform, and in doing so, so excited the admiration of all who heard him that they fell in love with his music immediately. Bach received on this occasion praise in abundance, but it is said that he did not receive a present of 100 louis d'ors, which the king had designed for him. Sebastian Bach's manner of managing the clavier was admired by all those who had the good fortune to hear him, and envied by all those who might themselves claim to be considered as good performers. That this mode of playing on the clavier so generally admired and envied must have been very different from that in use among Bach's predecessors and contemporaries may be easily imagined, but heretofore no one has explained in what this difference properly consisted. If we hear the same piece played by 10 equally skillful and practiced performers, it will produce under the hand of each a different effect. Each will draw from the instrument a different kind of tone, and also give to these tones a greater or less degree of distinctness. Whence came this difference arise, if otherwise all 10 performers have sufficient readiness and practice? Merely from the mode of touching the instrument, which in playing on the clavier is the same thing as the pronunciation in speech. In order to make the delivery perfect in playing as well as in speaking or declaiming, the greatness, distinctness is required. In the production of tones, as in the pronunciation of the words. But this distinctness is susceptible of very various degrees. Even in the lowest degrees, we can understand what is played or said, but it excites no pleasure in the hearer because this degree of distinctness compels him to some exertion of his attention. But attention to single tones or words ought to be rendered unnecessary, that the listener may direct it to the ideas and their connection. And for this we require the highest degree of distinctness in the production of single tones, as in the pronunciation of single words. And so this describes Bach, the clavier player. Bach, the organist. What we have said about Sebastian Bach's admirable performance on the clavier may also be applied in general to his playing on the organ. The clavier and the organ are nearly related to each other, but the style and mode of managing both instruments are as different as their respective purpose. What on the clavichord sounds well or expresses something expresses nothing on the organ, and vice versa. The best player on the clavier, if he is not duly acquainted with the difference in the purpose and object of the two instruments and does not know how to keep it constantly in view, will always be a bad performer on the organ, as indeed is usually the case. There is and was one exception. That was Johann Sebastian Bach. He was elegant on the clavier, and when he came to the organ, no trace of the clavier player was to be perceived. Melody, harmony, motion, all was different. That is, all was adapted to the nature of the instrument and to its destination. This, Johann Sebastian Bach as organist. From the manner in which Johann Sebastian Bach treated harmony and modulation, his melody necessarily assumed a peculiar form. In the union of several concurrent melodies, which are all to be flowing and expressive, no single one can be so prominent as to attract to itself alone the attention of the listener. This prominency the melodies must, as it were, divide among them, so that sometimes the one, sometimes the other may shine in particular, though its brilliancy seems to be diminished by the equally singing parts, because the attention of the hearer is shared by them. Besides, such a union of many parts obliges the composer to use certain turns in the single melodies to which he is not obliged in composition. Not all Bach's melodies fit this description. Though the same originality of thought prevails everywhere, the melodies of what are called his free compositions are so open, clear, and intelligent that they indeed sound differently from the melodies of other composers, but yet are comprehended by the most unpracticed listener, and even felt on account of the spirit that dwells in them. Most of the preludes in his well-tempered clavier, as well as most of the pieces in his greater and smaller suites, are of this description. There was also Bach the teacher. There are many good composers and skillful virtuosos for all instruments who are not capable of teaching others what they themselves know or can perform. Either they have not combined sufficient attention with the practice by which their natural capacity was developed, or they have been led by good instruction to a certain point on the shortest way, and have left to their teachers the task of considering why anything must be done so and so, and not otherwise. When such performers are well informed, Their practice may be very instructive to beginners, but they cannot give instruction in the proper sense of the term. The tiring path of self-destruction can be found in self-instruction, on which the learner goes astray 1,000 times before he discovers or reaches the goal. Perhaps the only one that can produce a perfectly good teacher is a man such as this. This is the case with the school of Bach. Its founder long wandered about. He had to attain the age of about 30 years and gradually to increase his powers by constant exertion before he learned how to conquer all difficulties and obstacles. But on the other hand, he discovered at the end perhaps the most beautiful and delightful road that is to be found in the whole domain of the art. Only he who knows much can teach much. Only he who has to become acquainted with dangers, who has himself encountered and overcome them, can properly point them out and successfully teach his followers how to avoid them. Both were united in Bach. His teaching was, therefore, the most instructive, the most proper, and the most secure that ever was known. And all his scholars trod at least in some one branch of the art, in the footsteps of their great master, though none of them equaled, much less surpassed him. During his 27 years in Leipzig, Bach complained of vexation, envy, and persecution at every step. Still, the pettiness of his life could not dry up his inspiration. In his first 2 decades, there he wrote a body of religious music that has never been equaled, nearly 300 cantatas for every holy day in the church calendar, 2 oratorios, masses, the St. John, the St. Matthew Passions, and the monumental B minor mass. Accomplishments astounding. And yet there is a glimpse of his character, a glimpse of his personality. Who was this man? And why was this man? Besides Bach's great merit as so accomplished a performer, composer, and teacher of music, he also had the merit of being an excellent father, a friend, and a citizen. His virtues as a father he showed by his care for the education of his children, and the others by his consciousness and his performance of his social and civil duties. His acquaintance was agreeable to everyone, whoever was in any respect a lover of the art, whether a foreigner or a native, could visit his house and be certain of meeting with a friendly reception. These social virtues, united with great reputation of his art, caused his house to be very seldom without visitors. As an artist, he was uncommonly modest, notwithstanding the great superiority which he had over the rest of his profession, and which he could not but feel, notwithstanding the admiration and reverence which were daily shown. As so outstanding an artist, there is no instance of his having ever assumed upon it. And when he was sometimes asked how he had contrived to master the art to such a high degree, he generally answered, "I was obliged to be industrious. Whoever is equally industrious will succeed equally well." He seemed not to lay any stress on his greater natural talent. All the opinions he expressed of other artists and their works were friendly and equitable. Many works necessarily appeared to him trifling, as he was almost always employed exclusively on the sublimer branches of the art, yet he never allowed himself to express a harsh opinion, unless it were to one of his scholars, to whom he thought himself obliged to speak pure and strict truth. Still less did he ever suffer himself to be seduced by the consciousness of his strength and superiority to be a musical bravado, as is so frequently the case with performers who think themselves strong when they believe they have an inferior one to do with. His modesty in this respect went so far that he never spoke voluntarily even of the musical contest which he was to have with Marchand, though he was not the challenger in this case, but the challenged. The many, sometimes adventurous pranks that are related of him, as for example that occasionally dressed like a poor village schoolmaster, he went into a church and begged the organist to let him play a chorale, in order to enjoy the general astonishment excited in the persons present by his performance, or to hear the organist say, "He must either be Bach or the devil." These are mere fables. He himself would never hear of anything of the sort. Besides, he had too much respect for the art thus to make a plaything of it. An artist like Bach does not throw himself away. In musical parties, where quartets or fuller pieces of instrumental music were performed, and he was not otherwise employed, he took pleasure in playing the viola, and with this instrument he was, as it were, the middle of the harmony, whence he could best hear and enjoy it on both sides. When an opportunity offered in such parties, he sometimes, almost always, accompanied a trio or other pieces on the harpsichord. If he was in a cheerful mood and knew that the composer of the piece, if he happened to be present, would not take it amiss, he used, as we have said already, a brass in a trio or other single parts in a quartet. These, however, are really the only cases in which he proved to others how strong he was. A certain Hurlibush of Brunswick, a conceited and arrogant clavier player, once visited him at Leipzig, not to hear him, but to let himself be heard. Bach received him kindly and politely, listened to his every piece and every word with great patience. And when Hurlibush, on taking leave, made the eldest sons a present of a printed collection of sonatas, exhorting them to study them diligently, Bach only smiled to himself and did not at all change his friendly behavior to the stranger. He was fond of hearing the music of other composers. If he heard in a church a fugue for a large body of musicians, and one of his two eldest sons happened to be standing near him, he always, as soon as he had heard the first entries of the theme, said beforehand what the composer ought to introduce and what possibly might be introduced. Now, if the composer had performed his work well, what Bach had predicted happened. Then he was delighted and jogged his son to make him observe it. This is proof that he valued, too, the skills of others. He had a very great esteem for Handel, and often wished to be personally acquainted with him. As Handel was also a great performer on the clavier and the organ, many lovers of music at Leipzig and in other neighborhoods wished to hear these two men confronted. But Handel never could find time for such a meeting. He came 3 times from London to Halle, his native town. On his first visit, about the year 1719, Bach was only 4 miles from Halle. He was immediately informed of Handel's arrival, and lost not a moment in paying him a visit. But Handel left the city the very day of his arrival. At the time of Handel's second visit, between 1730 and 1740, Bach was in Leipzig ill. And the third time, it could never have been possible. This time, not for Bach. Handel could not come. In 1752, or 1753, and Bach was dead. Bach did not make what is called a brilliant success in his world. He had on one hand a lucrative office, but he had on the other a great number of children to maintain and to educate from the income of it. He neither nor had sought other resources. He was too much occupied with his business and his art to think of pursuing those ways which perhaps for a man like him, especially in his times, would have led to a gold mine. If he had thought fit to travel, he would, as even one of his enemies had said, have drawn upon himself the admiration of the whole world. But he loved a quiet domestic life, constant and uninterrupted occupation with his art, and was, as we have said of his ancestors, a man of few wants. Moreover, he enjoyed during his life manifold proofs of love and friendship, and of great honor. Prince Leopold, Duke Ernest Augustus of Weimar, the Duke Christian of Weissenfels, had a sincere attachment to him, which must have been more valuable to the great artist, as these princes were not mere lovers, but also connoisseurs of music. At Berlin and Dresden, also, he was universally respected and honored. If we add the admiration of the connoisseurs and lovers of music who had heard him or were acquainted with his works, we shall easily conceive that a man like Bach, who sung only for himself and the muses, had received from the hands of fame all that he could wish for, and had more charms for him than the equivocal honors of a ribbon or a gold chain. This was the character of Johann Sebastian Bach. today, much of Bach's music sounds strange to our ears at first. The music we are accustomed to, popular songs, folk music, even much of the classical music of the last century, is constructed like an arch, with pillars of chords and the bass holding up a single melody. Bach's music was contrapuntal, melody piled on top of melody, and all of the melodies sounding at the same time, crossing one another, blending their tones, making a veritable oral tapestry. So perfect was the Bach craftsmanship that when, in an experiment long ago, a player piano roll of one of his compositions was reversed, so that the high notes became the bass and the low notes soared upward, the music sounded as melodious as before. Play a recording of Bach choral work, or one of his familiar organ works. The first time you hear it, pay attention to only the highest melody, the soprano. Now listen again, this time separating from the strands of melody the bass part. Next, concentrate on the middle voices alone. Soon, much of the music you are used to, those pillars of chords, will sound almost pedestrian. It is the genius of Bach that you can listen to him hundreds of times and continue to discover beauties previously unheard. A tribute from man to God. A man who wrote music for the heavens and received it in return. You have been listening to part one of The Visual Sounds of Mike Worf. Allow side one to expire and then turn cassette over for part two. No greater musical fiasco could be imagined than that which seemed in the making at Berlin's austere Academy of Song in March of 1829. A rambling work so unwieldy that it called for two sets of orchestras and choruses in rehearsal. A passion based on the Gospel of St. Matthew, it had caused scarcely a ripple of attention at its first performance 100 years before. Its composer was as little known as the music. Johann Sebastian Bach had lain in an unmarked grave for 8 decades, and conducting this passion was its unknown discoverer, a 20-year-old Jew named Felix Mendelssohn, who would now stand before a combined orchestra and chorus for the first time. As a boy of 14, Mendelssohn had come across a manuscript of the Passion at his teacher's home and had fallen in love with it. The music had almost no other credentials. Yet members of the Academy spread such favorable reports of the rehearsals that for the public performance every seat was taken. And from the first notes the listeners were swept up in a tide of religious emotion, for the St. Matthew Passion is perhaps the most deeply stirring music ever written. A cathedral hush greeted the lyric solos, the moving arias of contemplation, the ringing hymns of exultation. Not only did the audience hear and feel deeply, it also saw. For so great was the genius of this unknown Bach that he seemed able, with mere notes, to paint vivid stage scenery and create mood lighting. Each time the Christ spoke, for instance, Bach had surrounded the words with a shimmering halo of sound played by the strings. As Christ was led away, sounds evoked a picture of footsteps dragging under the weight of the cross. So successful was the performance that it had to be repeated not once, but twice, to packed halls. Thanks to Felix Mendelssohn, a sudden interest was kindled in Bach's music, and great composers fanned the enthusiasm. Chopin advised all pianists to study Bach closely. "This is the highest and best school," Chopin had said. "No one will ever create a more ideal one." Investigation revealed that many unpublished masterpieces by Bach had fortunately survived. Passions, masses, and oratorios, church cantatas, works for orchestra, string instruments, forerunners of the modern piano. Bach Society sprang up in Europe to search out and perform these neglected works. Today, Bach is entrenched in our hearts and lives. Only Mozart and Beethoven have more of their music on recording. The Bach Guild, a record company devoted exclusively to Bach and his period, has sold well over 1 million records. The best known of the Bach festivals is now in the United States. And so it is that the music still rings out, still rings true. Bach's musical settings for many Christian hymns can be heard on Sunday mornings. Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, perhaps his most popular. His music burns with an unquenchable religious vitality. For him, music was an act of worship, as if the notes, once out of range of human hearing, still ascended heavenward in a song of praise. The sole object of all music, he advised his students, should be the glory of God and pleasant recreation. On the margin of many of his scores, he scribbled the dedication, "To God alone the glory." Bach would make his journeys. The diligence with which, particularly in his younger years, he had frequently passed days and nights without intermission in the study of his art, had weakened his sight. This weakness continually increased in his latter years until at length it brought on a very painful disorder in the eyes. By the advice of some friends who placed great confidence in the ability of an oculist who had arrived at Leipzig from England, he ventured to submit to an operation which twice failed. He continued to decline for a full half year till he expired on the evening of the 30th of July, 1750, in the 66th year of age. On the morning of the 10th day before his death, he was all at once able to see again and to bear the light. But a few hours afterwards, he was seized with a convulsion. This was followed by a high fever, which his enfeebled frame, notwithstanding all possible medical aid, was unable to resist. Such was the life of a remarkable man. We only add that he was twice married, and that he had by his first wife 7, and by the second wife 13 children, namely 11 sons and 9 daughters. All the sons had admirable talents for music, but they were not fully cultivated, except in some of the elder ones. The life of Bach, a brilliant musician, who had received the gift of God and returned it in the best fashion he knew. Have been listening to the visual sounds of Mike Worf. Our presentation, The Life and Times of Johann Sebastian Bach, Music for the Heavens.